Hey, it's our last Tacky Talk of 2021 with State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy, who's back in his dining room now. Hi, Tacky.
Hey, Joe. Yes, today we're back in dining room. It's either me or the car, as you noticed in this podcast. Entertainment for you all, I suppose, or educational, or maybe a little both. I have no idea anymore, but it's the week of Christmas, and I wish you all in advance a happy holiday.
Indeed, same to you and your family and your colleagues as well. It's been an interesting year for sure, and it's getting more interesting even here at the end of it. What do you think about the governor's latest announcements with regards to the pandemic?
Well, I didn't think the governor was going to do a whole lot in terms of changing the current course of action. We know that the hospitals were going to have another overrun, like we saw last winter. Having the National Guard go in to help with the administration, hospitals, demonstrates two things. One, obviously, is the continuation of workforce shortage. And the second is people getting sick. I mean, you know, I think some people try to overblow the hospital releasing staff that wouldn't get vaccinated, because many hospitals were releasing staff that wouldn't get vaccinated. But again, it's a really tiny percentage. It's barely 1% in the hospital and healthcare industry that people were not vaccinated. So this workforce shortage cannot be attributed strictly to the people not wanting to get vaccination. The reality is last time we also had a surge, and there was already a manpower issue then between regular staffing and healthcare staff going down because they got COVID infections. So obviously you don't want to put more people at risk, which is why vaccination is so important, especially in a healthcare setting. But at the moment, it's not surprising. The surge is here. It's no longer the surge is coming.
Yeah, well, it's kind of the perfect storm. It's, lack of staff and increase in patients, and the two of them converging, forcing the governor's hand. I'm surprised he didn't mention reopening of field hospitals yet.
I am a little surprised by that. I would think that should be on the National Guard's to-do list, but I'm convinced that given the fact that they never really truly disassembled all the equipment, they could probably move within 24 hours or with the National Guard very quickly to set the field hospitals back into DCU, up in the Lowell Arena, back into Boston Convention Center. I don't think Boston is going to be too bad. I am worried about places like Lowell and Worcester County quite a bit. But Boston, you know, obviously has the densest number of hospital beds in the state. But, you know, we'll see how it goes. Let's hope it doesn't get worse. I mean, one of the things is that, again, we know how to treat it better. Treatments are better now, so people know what they're doing. We understand the infectious nature of it and the containment issues we have to do in hospital settings. There's more testing centers than ever, even though I know there's long lines because everyone's trying to get tested before the holidays. There is testing opportunity. Of course, we have the take-home kits that was distributed by the governor from the federal government. And, you know, you can still buy test kits, although it's very hard to find one right now. You know, at your local pharmacies, there are test kits, and they're not cheap. The rapid test kits are fairly more affordable at under $40, under $50. But the PCR test, it was looking at CVS, you know, cost like $130.
Wow.
And that's a two-day turnaround, or three-day turnaround, because you have to put it in the mail. It's expressed forward and back to results. So, there's more opportunity, but, you know, in terms of testing, but I mean, again, it's a supply demand problem. Mm-hmm. And no different than what we saw during the height of 2020. What we experienced when Delta first made its appearance in 2021.
Yeah. Do you think there should be a statewide mask mandate, Jackie?
Personally, I think we need to have a statewide mask mandate at this stage. I mean, it's been demonstrated that, again, mask, social distancing, and keeping clean, it's the same thing we've been talking about since 2020, March. These are the best ways to defend yourself against potential infection. And again, it's a respiratory disease. As the science has gotten better, I mean, you know, it's a you don't have as a high risk in terms of contact and physical surfaces, although you definitely should wash your hands. I'm not discouraging, because I have a thing about hand washing. I like hand washing. But in terms of the, infectious rate, you know, respiratory disease, you know, it comes out of your mouth and lungs and nose. So a mask is crucial. And, you know, in terms of defense, you know, the mask, again, I'm not going to pretend and tell you that the mask can stop viruses, because you don't have an N95. But what it does is it reduces the droplets from making impact on your face and your mouth area. It reduces the number of it. So it reduces the odds like 80, 90% of infection because of the droplets, the respiratory droplets. Conversely, if two people are masked up, your risk of infection drops to like well under 5% or so, something in that zone, because there are two people that can't release droplets into the air again to each other. Because of two people masked, the odds of infection goes down immensely because the droplets can't penetrate two sets of masks, especially if you're like 3 or 4 feet from each other, right? It's very logical. So the Omicron's out there and it's, it's moving like wildfire, much like Delta, but it's actually moving faster than Delta in terms of its infection ability.
Yeah, we've saw it in other countries, and now it is here, and probably will be. Although I've heard some doctors say, hopefully by the spring of next year, things will be easing up a bit. We'll see.
We'll see. Right now, the studies, and I know there's still very early data, so this could all change in 2 weeks or 4 weeks. I mean, this is the problem with dealing with COVID and its variants, is that they're constantly keeping up the studies, and it's a global issue. I mean, you have studies in Europe and the US and South Africa and Hong Kong and lots of countries. And as the scientific community is trying to get the data and get some consensus, the data may change around based on what they're seeing in real time. And this is kind of the hard part of dealing with this pandemic. It's real time analysis. So what I'm saying today, what I read or what I watched on the news may change in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. This has been very frustrating in terms of how to manage it from a healthcare standpoint, but also manage from a public policy standpoint, because it's just like the world isn't predictable in the sense that it's always going to be the same, right? We all know life changes, but it's extremely hard to deal with a disease that's this unpredictable on how it behaves. And you're trying to do healthcare and public policy on a global level, and shifting sands, waiting for data in real time to make the best decisions. And you don't know till you know. And that's kind of the problem where we are right now. Mm. What we thought we knew in the first version versus Alpha versus Delta and now Omicron. The question was, does it kill you faster? The answer is no. It kills you just as easy as the first three versions. It's the spread rate that's frightening everybody. It will especially infect the unvaccinated, and if you are vaccinated, you could still be a carrier and still be perfectly fine, which was the fear we had, especially with Delta.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think we'll ever see occupancy restrictions again and shutdowns, things like that?
I don't think so. And as we know, I can be pretty grim about this stuff, but I think it's really tied to death count.
Mm-hmm.
Once, if the death count reaches a certain number, and the doctors and scientists are watching these numbers of infection and death count, once it reaches a certain stage, a lock shutdown will have to happen because the death count is just out of control in relationship to the consumption of hospital beds and whatnot. And they can, because they can track you based on what hospital you're in, and they can collect the the zip code data. Is what they like to use, zip codes. They can start isolating where the problems are in terms of the high infection rates. And then, if a death count reaches a certain number, which I'm not sure what the number looks like, but, I would think that they would have to do a shutdown if enough people are dying.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Get vaccinated is the number one message, really.
No, absolutely. Again, Omicron thus far does respond to the vaccine. Vaccines are effective against Omicron. The studies are kind of all over the place, but efficacy rates are poorer against Omicron, particularly since your antibodies have waned over 6 months. But many countries are still waiting for their vaccines. I mean, it's kind of in a blessed situation here in the U.S. We actually have this capacity to vaccinate everyone like 150 times. It feels like we have so much vaccine. Many countries are still like crying and waiting for theirs in terms of desperation and horror in those countries because of infections and death. I mean, it's just sad and tearful and horrific to watch news of other places of high death counts, and they're not even sure because they don't have as good medical tracking. But it's disheartening to see that. We're very blessed here, and I think we sometimes underappreciate exactly how blessed we are.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, folks, I mean, get your vaccination, get your boosters. You know, as of last week, you know, well, over 1.7 million people in Massachusetts have gotten their booster. It looks very similar to when vaccines first came out, where, you know, they had a very high vaccination rate very quickly. It seems to be following the same pattern. Folks who were very diligent early, trying to get vaccinations when they were qualified for it, seems to be the same pattern is occurring. They're getting the boosters as soon as they qualify. The issue isn't vaccine availability. The issue is enough people who get out there to give you your jab.
Right.
And that's really the sticking block. It's not availability of vaccine. It's availability of people to give you a shot.
Again, the workforce shortage affects everything. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it's in, you guys all know at this point, it's in every pharmacy, health center, hospital. You know, I know not every doctor's office has it. For example, my doctor's office did not have it when I had my physical in November. They did not have any more available at the time. But, you know, there is no shortage of locations these days. So, you know, definitely go ahead and get your booster if you can. If you haven't got your vaccination, it's a good time to start now. Again, Omicron is moving through the unvaccinated very quickly. And we had talked a little bit before we came on about herd immunity. And the thing that news is not talking about is that the higher, more infectious disease, the higher percentage you need of vaccinations to slow the spread. So now you're seeing a situation where Omicron is supposedly five times more infectious than Delta, which is two times more infectious than Alpha, which is two times more infectious than the original. So two times two times two times five. So what does that mean? Well, that means that when it hits the unvaccinated population, it takes much shorter time period to infect the next unvaccinated person.
Right.
And if you are vaccinated, you still could be a carrier, but there's also a chance it could stop with you because if you don't get ill, they don't suffer any real effects. Maybe, you know, maybe super mild effects, you won't be, it stops you if you keep your mask on. Basically what I'm saying is that you're
right.
Vaccinated and you're potentially infected, just keep your mask on, you stop the spread. Again, you can't get, droplets can't leave your body easily. It keeps it from infecting others. And again, I mean, breakthrough cases, yeah, we hear about it all the time and it's real. We've always said this is a resistant vaccination. It's not immunity. I hate the word immunity. It's to reduce the possibility of illness and death. And again, the percentage are extraordinary low relative to vaccination regarding getting ill as well as potentially dying. But the boosters will increase your efficacy rate back into the 90s. If 90% rage, if you do get your booster and get those antibodies up. So, you know, again, Omicron is moving through the unvaccinated folks extremely fast.
Let's change topics a little bit, Jackie. talk about what's going on Beacon Hill these days.
Well, it's been fairly quiet on Beacon Hill. We've reached a holiday season. Obviously, there's no holiday parties in the state out. There's no holiday parties for the legislators. You know, we generally have some kind of a very large get together with people bringing their spouses and whatnot, and you know, girlfriends, boyfriends, or whomever. And that didn't happen this year. I've actually skipped a few of those parties because December is my month where I go away vacation. Obviously, that hasn't happened again for a while. So. It's extremely quiet. It's extremely quiet. Normally, like I said, this time of year, there'll be, you know, office parties and whatnot, like everyone else in your work life would have. And it's really quiet right now. You know, Eggmageddon has been avoided.
Oh, thank goodness.
Yeah, thanks. So,
about Porkmageddon?
No Porkmageddon either, thankfully. Okay. Well, Porkmageddon has been pushed off to August 15th.
Okay.
For my recap, for those who don't know, the voters voted to change how we, from whom we buy our eggs and pork from. So the voters changed from whom, based on how they create provide humane treatment pursuant to law regarding space to move around. Not to bore you with the details, but minimum space for animals to move around. And technology and methods have changed. The humane societies and animal welfare groups and agriculture industry have adopted new standards for both pork and egg production, and it's been accepted by those industries, and particularly the poultry industry has moved very quickly and able to get to these new standards on a national level. The standards the voters approved did not meet the new standards that have been created, so we had to pass a law to eliminate the current the voter ballot initiative to reflect the current standard has been accepted by both animal and humane advocates and societies and organizations, as well as the agriculture industry. Pork has not reached the same level of compliance. The pork industry is still working on that. We do expect they can meet the ballot question initiative, but they need more time. So the compromise and conference committee was August 15th, as opposed to January 1st of next year. So it gives the pork industry some more time to get there. And the bill was improved in informal session this week and sent to the governor. So I always remind folks that, you know, we're out of session, but we're not out of session. This is an example of a formal session, non-informal session, where one person can stop a movement of a bill, as well as a formal session where we're all gathered in the chamber. So, you know, obviously there's a higher risk in informal session of not moving something forward because someone could raise an objection and close down the session.
Right.
But if we can reach consensus among the membership, you know, we can get stuff done informal session. So that's, you know, this is kind of one of those things I keep talking about, why we're a full-time legislator. Sure. Unlike other states, if this had happened, they would either have called back a special session or they couldn't do anything at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So this is the traditional full-time legislature, which is what we have as an example you see here regarding ending preventing Eggmageddon versus another legislature when they shut down for six months to a year, depending on what state you're in.
Oh.
They do not address this issue of Eggmageddon.
Okay, so there's a benefit for having a full-time legislature. Otherwise, we'd all be eating powdered eggs.
Yeah, pretty much, yes, and paying, you know, $14 for a dozen. So
yeah, okay.
You know, that's,
have you started at all looking at the budget for next year, or is that too soon?
The Ways and Means held its revenue consensus meetings yesterday, which I have not watched. You can go on the state legislature's website and watch the, they recorded it. So you can watch the recording if you want. Again, this goes on for like between 4 and 5 hours. Mm-hmm. Just to warn you guys, if you want to watch these revenue hearings and you
know, binge watching them.
Exactly. And I did watch a couple hours last year because, you know, I'm glutton for punishment. And one of the challenges that in this format of, they use Microsoft Teams, not Zoom.
Uh-huh.
The format is somewhat disjointed because the screen keeps changing and it's hard to read the PowerPoints on a screen. It doesn't get big enough.
Yes, it's the reason we chose to use Zoom for TV here because it doesn't do that. Yeah.
Exactly. So it's not like an in-person revenue hearing. We have people sitting at a panel next to each other, much more less disjointed in the conversation because we've experienced here more than once when only one person can talk at a time and it gets awkward and two people talk, the system mutes, and you guys have done video know what I'm talking about this stage. So, I've not read the State House News Service on the revenue consensus number, but I suspect it's going to be very generous. Actually, you know what? Since we're on my computer, since we have this new laptop, let's do some real time thing here.
Ooh, okay, yes. I know Treasurer Goldberg, gave a testimony and it all looked good, including the lottery revenues, which became quite healthy over the past year, she said.
Yeah, the revenues had record numbers. So as you guys will watch my eyes move over the place because I can't keep my eyes on one spot on the screen, I'm going to bring up the State House News Service article on this. And experts largely agree Massachusetts can expect to collect about $36.4 billion and as much as $40.8 billion in tax revenues for next year's budget cycle. Fiscal year 22 has changed the projection of collecting between $35.726 billion and $36.623 billion, which is between $1.325 and $2.222 billion more revenue from last year, basically above our expectation of benchmark. So so we are revising again as we go along our revenue numbers for next fiscal cycle. As you can see, we are continue to be very shocked by the growth of the tax revenues, which again is reflecting inflation. And while we're experiencing inflation, this is one of the interesting side effects associated with that. And of course, the just sheer amount of money in federal stimulus that got it into people's hands to spend to help businesses try to do their best. Again, it's, I wish I could say we could help everyone, but we're trying to help the most we can, we can. And, unemployment rate is, it's under, I believe it's under 5% in Massachusetts. I think it's 4% ish in on the national level. And despite the fact that, there's a workforce shortage and hospitality is still having issues. And, Boston has implemented a new new program that's going to have an impact on them regarding COVID restrictions on vaccination cards. I'm still very surprised at, very, very surprised at the revenues are so strong on tax revenue. I just still can't believe it.
Well, people are paying more things, so there's more taxes being generated, right?
Well, it's also the capital gains is out of control still. I mean, the market I know has slumped for a little while. And I've seen Bitcoin jump up and down a bit and slumped a little too, as people are trying to find new kind of commodities to make money off of. But I mean, home sales have slowed down only because of lack of supply, not because of lack of demand, which is also capital gains. And the market is ridiculous. The stock market is ridiculous. I'm not complaining because my long-term retirement fund plans look suddenly healthier than I ever thought it ever would. I mean, it's, 20 years later kind of money, right? Yeah. I mean, we're never going to see the benefit of this today, but, for long-term. But yeah, I mean, that's actually part of it as well. And white-collar jobs have been stable for the most part. It's the lower wage working jobs that has a lot of vacancies.
Yeah. How are the stimulus bonus payments going to be handled, Tacky? Because I know that the governor eliminated the 28-member panel review committee to send those out. So what happens now?
Well, it's going to be left in the governor's hand. He controls the group insurance commission. If I remember correctly, it's going through the group insurance commission administratively.
Okay.
And he's going to have to probably get the rules and regulations how to distribute, qualify, and apply for these funds. So it's really in his control now. And since he eliminated the, I know it's kind of, he called it a really onerous group, but I mean, it eliminates a degree of oversight from other parties that has a vested interest in the matter. So, he's in charge.
Basically, he's writing the checks now. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, basically. So, $500,000 for this program will, I'm sorry, $500 million, not half million, $500 million, even if a cap of 2,000 per head, it will evaporate pretty quickly. So I suggest you all keep an eye on the news and social media and follow the state's various social media pages to know when this program is going to go into effect, and then you can apply for it as quickly as you can.
Yes.
It sounds like a lot of money, but when you think about the number of folks that are making only 30% of poverty level, it's a lot more than we realize.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Good advice, certainly. For your committee, Tacky, what's 2022 hold?
Oh, 2022, we got this racing bill that I still need to do, but not sure what's going on, because generally we have a piece that affects several industries. You would hear from those industries, and frankly, I've not heard from those industries. So I'm kind of like, why am I not getting a meeting here? I mean, it's a little baffling. So we're trying to figure that out. We're doing the car right to repair hearing very quickly. I believe we're going to try to get that on the calendar for January 10th. We're going to also do the expansion of alcohol licenses, which includes the ballot question on January 10th. We did a public hearing then. We got some bills we're looking at. We're still doing research on, for example, fair housing discrimination issues on renters. The staff is still doing a lot of research on that to see if we can come up with something that makes some sense regarding addressing some of the inequities and discrimination behaviors.
Mm.
Again, we're just researching it still. So we're not sure what that's going to be. Okay. What else are we researching? Health clubs, as you guys are all familiar, last year, the Boston Sports Club, I believe, was not giving people the refunds during pandemic and eventually went to some level of bankruptcy. We've been actually looking at this quite a bit since that incident and trying to rewrite the healthcare laws to actually be consumer friendlier. They actually aren't that consumer friendly now, actually, when you read them. So the office has been working with the Attorney General's office, try to, you know, find a way to kind of do the delicate balancing act, right? You want to ensure consumer protection and maintaining responsibilities, but also the goal is not to really hurt an industry that is hurting right now. When it comes to some of the delicate balances, my goal is not to run you out of business. My goal is just to hold you somewhat accountable, that that consumers are made whole, not because, you know, because you're not behaving as a business that should be behaving. You're being unfair. So, you know, we got that one that the staff was researching on. You know, we do have the division of occupational licensing, the old division professional licensure, DPL, which is now DOL. They have a very small bill, but very wide-reaching new enforcement bill. And I've been going through that and trying to run scenarios of what would happen if we implement different parts of it and what its impact on licensees and consumers would be.
Is this the Body Works bill?
No, this is actually expansion of enforcement powers. So they want to be able to expand their suspension of licenses and fines and reorganize some of their enforcement protocols or enforcement arm of their agency. So, you know, on the surface, it looks a good idea. Everything on the surface in my business is a good idea. But once you actually start thinking about like applying it in real life and start writing scenarios, well, how would this work if this happened? How would it work if this happened? And then it becomes much more complex. People's gut instincts on legislation often is like, I see it. Oh, this makes perfect sense. And just walk away. Well, you don't have to live with it.
Right.
As I tell folks.
And you can never run every scenario that, you know, you just can't think of every single one until one of them comes up.
Precisely. So we try to run as many as possible, you know, as we talk to each other. I miss talking to each other in person, but, you know, it's always easy when you're in person or, you know, in a room and just start throwing ideas at you. Okay, we do this, what would happen? We do this, what would happen?
Right.
And this includes like abuse of power by the agency. That is just what happens to consumers. So do you want, you know, a government agency having this much breadth of enforcement and what potential abuses that could occur? Okay. You know, whether we can put safeguards against those. So, I mean, the enforcement things sound great on the surface. I think you guys all will probably read the bill right off the bat. You say, oh, this is wonderful. And yeah, you just read on the surface. But if you start going through mechanics of it, maybe yes. Maybe no.
Right. Yeah. And it has to meet legal challenges too, right?
Yeah. We like to avoid those.
Yeah.
So if we can run the scenarios correctly, of potential of how things really work in real life, not just imaginary in my head life. You know, the idea is that it avoids possible legal challenges, particularly enforcement bills, unlikely to face any legal challenges in enforcement. Okay.
Yeah.
Because it's very straightforward.
Right.
You know, there's already existing statutory appeal mechanisms for people that have feels like they've been unjustly treated by enforcement of the licenses. But this is actually expansion of the existing enforcement powers to reach deeper into other things.
Okay.
Not necessarily bad, but we like to, you know, run through the whole idea of it. But that's one that's actually taking quite a bit of time. So, you know, those are kind of like three or four or five things that we're researching on right now. And I'll be updated more on a few other things. I got some meeting later this afternoon with my vice chair regarding so-called Ollie's Law, which is attempting to regulate dog sitting businesses. Okay.
Yep.
So the advocates have been working with the staff, and my vice chair is taking the lead on the matter. I'm going to talk to the vice chair to get updated about what her thoughts on the matter is. My vice chair is Mary Keith from Worcester. So, again, I mean, part of being a chair is you kind of give everybody work.
Well, yeah, that's delegating is part of it, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. And give people a chance to see what they think about something, and then we'll have a conversation. So, you guys can all tell I have a lot of things going in my head at one time.
Yes, a lot of balls in the air for sure.
It's not always just, what was I talking to somebody about this the other day? You know, it's I get the whole Tip O'Neill, you know, concept that, you know, all politics is local. And it's actually, you know, the thing people tend to forget about is that on the second half of that, Tip, the thing is, even though Tip says a lot, Tip actually, through his practice, showed that it is more than just local. It's local plus you have this larger responsibility to in our case, statewide. So obviously, the entire delegation, including everyone here, supports and wants to work for our local constituencies, including like a senator situation or the speaker and Bruce, which have multiple communities, right? It's local, not just Quincy, but local in their case, Randolph and Weymouth and Hoboken, and John Keenan's case, has Braintree, Holbrook, Rockland, and now upcoming Hanover is coming up next. And he loses Abington,
Right.
and Hanover. But I mean, local means more than just Quincy if you represent more than Quincy. I'm very fortunate being just Quincy, right? So people should be mindful. Local means more than just you watching us here, colleagues. But also, these bills I work as committee chair. Bruce is vice chair. John is a chair, as well as the speaker, who is really a statewide office holder now because Ron is representing the whole House body by every time he goes out, as well as mindful of statewide and other states' regional interests beyond just being Quincy. It's something that we have to kind of move beyond just, well, okay, this is how we do things at home. So everybody in the state should do everything the same way we do at home, right?
No, you go past Worcester and it's a whole different state.
As I've been past Worcester a few times, and people know I'm afraid to leave Quincy to start with, and COVID hit, so reinforces my desire to stay home. But yes, you're absolutely correct. As I said earlier, I've been to Ludlow, talking about the hospitality industry out there, and East Amherst and Northampton and those areas, and very different economics, very different structures, very different like everything on how to do business in those areas versus us in Quincy and Boston, the region here.
Oh yeah, you're dealing many times with volunteer government boards, town meetings, select boards. Not they don't have mayors, they don't have administrators. It's a completely different ball game.
So the biggest error in leadership in the legislature is that if you apply your learnings in the community you grew up in and you represent to a community that isn't that and is completely different, all you're doing is the service to them as much as the service people at home. So as a result, in leadership positions, like the entire delegation's in leadership now, which is great. We think about very much at home. For example, we got $50 million for the MBTA station. Help to try to start restart a master plan for that, right? Something we can do because of the strength of delegation, and large thanks to the speaker. Conversely, the speaker has an interest, and so do all of we, about windmill development, which really only affects the South Coast, was regarding construction windmills. Again, $100 million for windmill construction, which obviously in Quincy doesn't mean too much in Quincy because those aren't jobs for us per se, direct jobs for us. But I mean, it is a statewide interest as well as a regional interest to have clean, renewable energy.
But somebody in Pepperell doesn't care about the Quincy Center T station.
Absolutely. Like they don't care about MBTA fares. They don't care about NWRA. I mean, those are our regional and local interests, right? So as I deal with hospitality, I have a full understanding, for example, the impact of the university closings last year, when students weren't here, the enormous economic ripple. As I talked to my colleagues in the College Valley areas about how devastated the local economy became. And then when I actually see some of these restaurant owners and the business development people and walk through about the economic damage COVID has caused, it has is a different type of economic damage because of where they are versus the type of economic damage in Boston and Quincy and the Cape. So, this is kind of the, as you pointed out, I have a lot of balls in my air because I had a lot of things in my head at one time. So even then, I'm really good at on the spot questioning. But when you have enough going on in your head, you got to sort through a whole lot of things to try to find the answer you ask. Trying to find the answer to the question you asked me some days, I'm trying to sort it through in my head.
Well, we can always follow up the next week if we can't get the answer. Let's talk about national policy a little bit. What do you think about the president's $2 trillion environmental social justice bill being stalled?
Well, I was actually, again, as I keep saying, talking to my other friends about this stuff. I decided to look at Senator Manchin's poll numbers just for kicks. And his last set of poll numbers came, I believe, in early November or late October. There were several polls all the summer. And how he's handling that in that this issue on the spending plan has gotten very high poll numbers, like over 65% high poll numbers. He has a better favorable rating than both Biden and Trump.
Wow. I think he's setting himself up for a run for the White House?
I would think not. However, his reelection year is next year.
Ah, interesting. Okay.
So the polls also show that he is the state of Virginia's people. I like the idea of having a bipartisan Senate delegation. He has a Republican and Democrat, and they like the idea of bipartisan work on both the Republican and Democrat, which translates to they don't like to see a split vote.
Yeah.
They like to have both Democrat and Republican senators vote together.
Okay.
In Congress is what that translates to my mind when I see they want their two senators working together. Translation to me is they want to vote the same, right? Manchin's got a very, very big problem in his hands because West Virginia as a state actually benefits a lot from this spending plan. It is not a wealthy state. It is a very much a healthcare need state. It's very much a Medicare, Medicaid state.
Oh, yeah. It was very impacted by the coal industry years ago. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. This is a state that enormously benefits from Obamacare. Yeah. I mean, and they hate Obamacare. Again, it's the most bizarre thing where they get right. benefit with health care, but they also hate it, but not understand they're receiving it. It's whatever. It's this weird psychological phenomenon I've been noticing for a long time.
Mm.
But it's he actually is a very, very interesting political dilemma. Re-election next year. Really high poll ratings on what he's doing now regarding being challenging on it. He's aware that this bill actually has direct benefits to his state.
Of course.
But that doesn't, but the way it's being presented on national media doesn't translate that well to local. For example, when we talk about that bill, at what point is anybody watching this knows what that bill actually has benefit to Massachusetts residents, whether it be in the Berkshires, the Cape, or Lowell, or Boston, right? None of us.
I report on it every day, and I can honestly say I don't know the particulars of it. Absolutely, yeah.
Welcome to Joe Manchin's problem.
Right.
The messaging is impossible for him to try to manage to vote yes, given the vagueness of how this is reporting in big picture and the talking heads on Sunday morning news. And he now finds himself in this very interesting dilemma and politics, which I frankly am not envious in this position, where being an obstacle gives you high poll ratings into a state which leans Republican as a long, long time Democratic politician. He's not a new politician. He's been doing this a very long time at both the state and federal level and trying to figure out how to navigate knowing that the bill helps folks at home, but being an obstacle is good. And they want to see both Democrat and Republican senator vote for the same thing.
Right, right. So, boy,
yeah. The same thing.
That's a tough nut to crack. So, yeah, do you do what's right for a majority of your constituents, or do you play the political game?
Well, this is also the challenge of party line voting, as you guys all discovered. I mean, if I hear from folks that I hear from folks all the time that. He's such an obstacle. Why did he just follow the party line? Then again, hear from saying, well, you should never follow the party line because, you're just a lemming. I mean, you can't have it both ways, people.
Right.
You can't say you follow the party line and you shouldn't follow the party line. You should follow the best you can do the job you're doing, right?
Yeah.
He has that really peculiar problem. And, if you watch the talking heads, the one talking head that's been really quiet is Chuck Schumer.
Mm-hmm. You're right. That's true.
Yep. Schumer and McConnell's makes both of them be very quiet about the Manchin issue.
Yes.
Both leaders in the Senate. They know the poll numbers. The DNC knows the poll numbers. The RNC knows the poll numbers. The president knows the poll numbers. They know. And it's very curious how they're all doing media spin. And oddly enough, the more Biden attacks mentioned, his poll number is probably going to improve next month. Now, I know it sounds weird, guys, but I'm not saying this is by design either, by the way. I'm not saying Biden's intentionally attacking him for his poll number approval.
Right.
I mean, this tit for tat going on during the Christmas period between Manchin's office and the president's office and Bernie Sanders, which, it's Bernie, and various Democrats in the House, which some of them voted against the infrastructure bill, which again is a whole different conversation about this. may actually improve Manchin's poll numbers in January when the next polling come out. The Manchin issue is actually very, very interesting from a person on ground level politics who, and if your objective is to win re-election for six more years, we have a tough election season coming up. If you're a Democrat watching this here with us, do you want to take a chance on losing the Senate to Republicans next year or not?
Right. Yeah. And that's really what it comes down to. It's going to be very interesting. It's interesting, too, that Biden and Manchin obviously worked together in the Senate.
Yeah. And Biden has a long history of working many of the older senators. So they have a working relationship for many years. So they kind of know how to talk to each other. But, like everyone in politics, people should be sensitive to other people's local issues. As we talked earlier, local versus big picture.
Mm-hmm.
It is a classic conflict. We're trying to resolve that. But also he has a big problem. Again, it's a messaging problem with the talking heads and on the big news channels, between Fox and CNN, MSNBC, and all of the online Facebook and YouTube and all these alternative media outlets, spinning this bill as, the end of the world or socialism or is a savior bill or whatever the heck you want to call it, right? I don't care, just whatever you call it. That's what our constituents are learning, not just mentions, but also our own constituencies. That's where they get their line of information from. Yeah. So now you're in this funny, interesting situation where all they know is what the talking heads tell them. And the talking heads are attacking or praising him as opposed to actually discussing what does it really mean to West Virginians.
Right. Which is really what they should be talking about, yeah. And what he should be talking about too, actually.
Yeah, but he can't fire out a message against the talking heads.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll see where that one goes. What do you think what do you think about Marty Walsh coming to help negotiate the end of the nurses' strike out in Worcester?
Yeah, never heard of a Secretary of Labor come down to Worcester to negotiate a nurses' strike. It's a new one for me.
Yeah.
I know we talked in all politics is the local, but Marty's got bigger problems than, I'm sorry to say, than the Worcester nurses' strike.
I was shocked when I heard that. Yeah.
Yeah, he's got national policies he's got to drive through Congress. So I don't even know what those policies are, but he's going to have to be, pushing those agendas. And I was very surprised. I mean, he's been floating around for a good week and a half, the opening of the rail in Springfield. He's not the transportation secretary. Your reports of him floating around with, like at the Harvard Club type places, catching up with old friends. And I had word through the grapevine, some of his folks have been talking about running for governor.
Yes.
Prior to Baker's announcement, they had been already kind of, for lack of a term, putting out feelers.
Mm-hmm.
See what the response would be. And we know he has $5.1 million or so in his campaign account that's still active. And now he has kind of a national slash statewide, obviously, recognition because of the nature of his position in the administration. But he's not even been there 1 year yet.
I know.
So it's fun speculation and it's a fun news cycle locally for a week.
Well, that's what this podcast is about, Jackie, right? Having fun and speculating.
Exactly. So what does it mean? It means I don't know. I mean, obviously, the map says he's positioned to run for governor. But then again, flip side, he's been in the Biden administration less than one full year.
Yeah.
He does have the monkey of being from Boston. Generally, politicians from Boston do very poorly statewide. I'm from Quincy. Everybody, I'm from Quincy, not from Boston. Constantly reminding people from anywhere west of Worcester, not from Boston. We'll see how it plays out.
We'll see how it plays out. Yeah. All I can think of is it's Mike Dukakis all over again.
Yeah, it does feel that way, doesn't it? The nomination papers will be out sometime in February. We are anticipating that, not we in the sense of we in words, but I mean, me and my friends have been talking a lot and we're trying to trade notes.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on, piecing together. We believe that, my friends and I believe that, after a whole lot of speculating, that Amora Healey is probably going to make an announcement sometime between Christmas and New Year's.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
That's what we're thinking.
Oh, I can't wait to see
again, that happen. Speculating, folks. This isn't like a science here in politics.
Right, right, yeah.
Change their minds. But a lot of us are now speculating that she's going to make an announcement between Christmas and New Year's. Quentin Pelfrey has been running around since the summertime saying she's running for AG, only if she's not running for AG, but please give me money in case she is. It's Quentin. Quentin Pelfrey ran around all summer saying, hey, I want to be AG if Maura doesn't run to be AG and runs for governor. Please give me money should she run for governor. And it's like, what? I'm not going to give you money for a position that's not open. I mean,
it's just in case.
You should see the emails I get, folks. It's just like, what? What's her name? Lisa Sheridan. I can't get people's names mixed up. She was going to run against Ed Markey in the primary last year. She pulled out.
No.
And now she's opened a, I can't remember her name right now. I know it's Reardon. Last name's Reardon. She opened a campaign account for AG.
Oh, okay.
So that's another indicator that Moore is going to run for governor. As no big surprise, folks, we all know she's the big dog in the race, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Most money, best organizational capacity, mm-hmm. existing organizational capacity, and highest name recognition of all the Democratic primary candidates.
Yeah. Although, again, you know, there's a history there of attorney generals not doing really well in gubernatorial races here in Massachusetts.
Yeah, they really have a problem in the final. They have survived primaries. I mean, you know, Martha Coakley got through a really hard primary.
Right.
Riley got through, did not get out of a primary. Deval Patrick beat Riley in a primary.
That's right.
Hoshbarger got through a primary.
Yep.
Frank Bellotti did not get through a primary.
Right, right.
The difference those years and this year, although Bellotti is a little bit before my time because Silber was a kind of an interesting character on that race, which you have to talk to someone older than I have regarding that race. Because that was always been kind of a very interesting study. But I mean, right now it's a very weak field in Democratic primary.
Yes. Yeah. Which could benefit her. Yeah.
Which could benefit her. Daniel Allen has the most money at about $500,000 after a year of raising. I know it's COVID. It's hard to, actually, it's very hard to raise money in COVID.
Yeah.
But Moran comes in with a lot of huge advantages, more so than the other ones.
Yeah.
And the LSD party as a whole, the party decides, the people in the Democratic voting bloc decides they're looking for alternative choices, but everyone is relatively similar. You end up going to one of the highest probability to be governor.
Yep. You don't want to quote unquote waste your vote, I guess. Yeah.
Well, correct. If all things being relatively equal in your candidates mean that, you know, the 98% identical,
mm-hmm.
right? Unless that remaining 2% is crucial for you as a Democrat primary voter, that you have to go with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
You generally will pick the person who has the highest probability of beating the Republican.
Yep. Yep. You jump on the bandwagon, essentially.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if they're almost all the same, pick the one that has the best resources to win.
Right. Yep. Exactly.
There's a practicality to politics that I think that people underestimate, or voters. You know, I do think voters went back and candidate wants the candidate to win. I mean, it's kind of like common sense. But in primaries, the goal is to try to find a candidate that has the highest probability of winning the final. If all things being equal in ideology, they're all essentially going to be the same. It's not the same, but, you know, extremely similar.
Mm-hmm. Platforms. Mm-hmm. Yep.
However, if you have a primary candidate that's a different enough platform that's unique, but still follows Democratic principles, that throws an interesting wrench. If people are looking for alternative choice, or was presented with a new idea they never thought of, that has a degree of creativity, that while deviates from traditional politics, you know, may still follow through on the principles you want.
Right. Good explanation, Tacky. I like that. Yep.
Yeah, I know. I had dinner with the Taiwanese director general. We were talking about politics, and I was talking about his time with a Harvard professor about political stuff in Taiwan. And not like I'm an expert in Taiwan politics, but I do watch enough news. I do know how basically their system works. And I told him, you have two choices. You can get the guy with the PhD or to get the guy that needs to win a fight. See, I don't have time to ponder the academia over elections.
Right, right.
I'm all winning a fight.
Yeah.
So we were laughing about that because, I can break down how a system works on elections and things like that. And you know, there are rules to the game and laws, and you got to figure out how to navigate it. Like, actually a big conversation piece we had last time and we didn't follow up, but yet is on the Hong Kong elections on Sunday.
Yeah, that nobody's going to show up for.
Yeah. For those who don't know, the Hong Kong, since it's a conversion to China, handover to China from the British, one of the agreements under their basic law, which is their kind of like constitution, it's a little bit weird, allows them to have some form of direct elections. But again, like all these legal documents, particularly in international affairs, these documents tend to be vague in certain areas.
Mm-hmm.
And Hong Kong doesn't have a governor or a mayor. They have what's called the chief executive, a CEO, because they refuse to acknowledge that it's a political position. And the CEO is elected by electoral college. It's not elected by the voters.
Right.
It's elected by electoral college that's created by Beijing, the central government, that then elects the voters. Now, there's a small percentage of those folks that actually elect directly from the public. And it is the central government in Beijing that chooses the choices for the next CEO. Carrie Lam, it's a 1 5-year term. You can't repeat. So Carrie Lam is coming up to end for a 5-year term. In the meantime, every 4 years, you have a legislative council race. And it's changed again. Initially, the majority of seats were constituencies, meaning that special interest groups designated by the central government in Beijing would hold those seats, and those special interest groups would have to select with the approval of Beijing who holds those other seats. And then you have direct elections for a minority seats, in this case down to 40. Now, before that, it was 40 and 40, 40 elected, 40 constituencies, and then you had this five, I'm trying to think of this, it's an even number legislature. So then you had these five at large, and he had five additional direct appointments from Beijing. It's really, the problem is this thing's changed like five different times.
Mm.
It's hard to track a little. So, but this time out though, the change in Hong Kong that's really different is the Patriot, it's now being for a Patriots only election.
Mm-hmm.
The overseas media is referring to it as. And what does that mean? Well, for you to run in local elections, including the district council elections, which is not really a political body, basically just elected people to do constituent services when you come right down to it. You have to sign a pledge card, literally what it sounds like. It's not an oath of office, it's a pledge card.
Mm-hmm.
Saying your loyalty to the Chinese government.
Oh.
And the way it's set up is that it any law that applies today, that if you did something bad in the past that violates the law, you can be arrested for it.
Okay.
So it's like saying that, you know, you chewed bubble gum when you were 22, and now today bubble gum has been outlawed. Because you chewed bubble gum when you're 22, you can be arrested for chewing bubble gum.
Okay.
You guys all see where I'm going here?
Yeah, it's not a true democracy.
It's not even fair. And given the fact that, you know, under the national security law, again, it's somewhat vague. I mean, it's basically anyone colludes with a foreign interest. Not even the word collude. I think engages in anytime engagement of foreign interest. Like if you talk, for example, if someone talked to me as a sitting elected official about democratic structures, you know, in a public forum, like, you know, we could be arrested.
Yep.
Potentially, because it's vague enough that you could be interpreted that way. Right. And even though it's not actual me sitting there starting rebellion, just having a conversation.
No, but I'm sure it's intentionally vague because of that. Yeah.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And this is where it gets very problematic. So during the last election cycle where people were very emboldened to vote, they were approached close to 70% turnout. And the trade with the voter elections in Hong Kong, ever since they started allowing elections, they've always been growing, even though they could never win the majority of seats.
Mm.
This time out, there's 30% turnout.
Yeah.
And one so-called token opposition candidate win one seat.
Yeah.
So part of this national security law also resulted in dissolution of political parties. So, you know, all the, this is a parliamentary style. So it's not a two-party system like in the U.S. We have two parties, a whole bunch of very minor parties, right?
Yeah, Yeah.
Over there, they don't really have two parties. They have a lot of mid-sized parties.
Yeah. It's kind of like the UK in that matter. Yeah.
Yeah, they have two major parties, but they have like three other parties that are, especially the Lib Dems in Britain, who suddenly become extremely relevant. But even though they don't hold a lot of seats, they have enough to make things interesting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In Hong Kong, it's actually very much of everyone's a mid-sized car. And it got some compacts at the back.
Yeah.
But I mean, a lot of those are pro-democracy or pro-independence or whatever parties, and they've all been wiped out in favor of only parties remaining that are pro-Beijing parties.
Right. Yeah.
So what does it mean for Hong Kong in the future? It creates a very interesting conversation here about twofold. On the one front, the Beijing party is always accused of democratic supporting parties that they couldn't get anything done because there's housing crisis that makes us look like a joke.
Mm.
It's really bad over there. It's unfairly bad over there. But, the argument's always been, the democratic supporters, who are the minority group, makes it impossible to get anything done. Now they control 100% of everything. So what does get done? And, when I say constituencies, I mean, part of the group that isn't elected includes the biggest business owners, the biggest real estate developers, the biggest economic interest tied to Taiwan. They've knocked out all the conventional unions. But even the teachers' union in Hong Kong had to dissolve because I know there's some party here bringing support or opposed unions watching this, but over there, unions was actually part of the constituencies of people that they, that are part of the government.
Yeah.
And some of these have been dissolving, and the remaining associations/unions that are pro-Beijing are now remaining.
Yeah.
Because again, the national security law and these Patriot Pledge cards has caused a lot of uncertainty regarding whether or not they are committing a crime and could potentially be arrested.
They're slowly taking the island back, basically.
It's extremely obvious that converting the island to a pure communist political structure.
Right.
They'd already started at the beginning where because it wasn't pure. Now, people ask, what's the big deal? Back 2 years ago, you had the district elections, which is, again, the constituent service votes. And there's like 800 or so of these seats. Very, very small voting demographic, very small districts. And the pro-democracy people swept like 83% of them, right? So they got afraid because if they can sweep all the district seats, plus they could sweep the statewide, the citywide seats, the citywide councilor type seats, there's a potential to get over a tie, a tie legislature.
Yeah.
But that only depends if all the different democratic fractions get over themselves, which is the hardest part of politics, and decide to put aside a difference and band together as a unit. They could. Now, historically speaking, the people who vote for pro-democracy have always had a higher vote total than the pro-Beijing folks until this year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The number, it's always been a pro-democracy as a raw number of voters have the higher number than the Beijing guys.
Yeah.
So now, of course, because of the low turnout, obviously the Beijing numbers look incredible.
Right.
In terms of the total number of voters. And, as much as, we talk about electoral colleges on a federal level, there is no electoral colleges below that. And we don't do designated constituencies, meaning that certain interest groups are guaranteed seats in government.
Right. No. Yeah. Exactly. That's a stark difference. We'll have to talk about the results next time we get together, Jackie.
Yeah, I'll do a little more reading look around and see how that plays out. Something to think about, folks.
In the meantime, we'll reach out to you in the usual ways, right?
Yeah. 617-722-2014. 617-722-2014. Mash the button. My voicemail is working. As well as the staff, just hit a staffer, we'll get to you. We'll get back to you as we can. Please remember to leave a phone number. I'm discovering this again. People need to leave us a phone number, otherwise we can't get back to you. So if you do call us, please do remember a phone number. Email me at tacky.chan@mahouse.gov, tacky.chan@mahouse.gov. Obviously my testimonies are down right now, so I'm actually able to sort through my email faster than I did a week ago. And you can catch up with my comings and goings and State Representative Tacky Chan Facebook page, which you do not need to be a Facebook participant to have access to my page. You can watch my past hearings and see all the crazy stuff I say. And tackychan.org, we put some phone numbers up there to help folks that may not have to call us. You can find relevant information there and call the right person from that point. Of course, you know, spending time with Joe here on QATV once a week. You know, always go through the archives and, you know, check out my different hairstyles and what crazy thing I said the week before.
What's on your Christmas wish list, Tacky?
Well, Christmas wish list is wish everybody just have a happy and safe, you know, Christmas and a new year. And like we said last year, hope that 2022 goes a lot better than 2021 and 2020. But most importantly, you know, everyone please be safely well. Keep yourself safe. Keep your family safe. We're just going to have a quiet quiet Christmas here. You know, just my immediate family, some brunch, some dinner, and some holiday films. And that pretty much sums up our Christmas. Right now, that's the most important thing.
Very good. Well, I want to wish you and your family, your staff, a very happy, healthy holiday season and better 2022.
You too, Joe. You and your family and everyone out there. And I'll see you in the year turns.